You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome to our viewers here in D.C. and across the USA and around the world. Thank you for joining this Brookings Institution event titled How COVID-19 and the Oil Shock Will Reshape the Middle East, or as I'm thinking about it, No Going Back. Brookings is one of the oldest and largest public policy think tanks here in Washington. We're used to meeting in person, and webinars are something relatively new to the crisis, but that enables us to reach many people around the world. Before COVID-19, countries across the Middle East were already facing a crisis of some combination of poverty, corruption, and an absence of freedom. It's a region where many of the country's top 1% earn more than the bottom 50%. It's a region where many countries and peoples have seen horrendous civil wars in places like Libya, Syria, and Yemen. In places like Algeria, and Sudan have seen transitions and protests, as well as in Iraq and Lebanon. And now we've got the coronavirus COVID-19 crisis. To talk about things and where we go from here, I am so honored to host this amazing panel with wonderful colleagues like Jihad Azur, director of the IMF's Middle East and Central Asia Department and former finance minister of Lebanon about a decade ago, Dr. Rilla Dushti, who's Undersecretary General and Executive Secretary of the Beirut-based UN agency ESQWA, the Economic and Social Commission for West Asia. She's also a former Minister of Planning in Kuwait. And of course, my wonderful colleague, Samantha Gross, here at Brookings, who's an expert and fellow in energy studies. I'll remind listeners to submit questions via email at events@brookings.edu or tweet us at Brookings FP, and we'll address as many of the questions as we can in the Q&A. Jihad, turning to you first, let's talk about the numbers. How bad is the economic crisis across the Middle East? Which economies are likely to fare best and worst? And what should governments be doing? So Jihad, over to you. Unmute.
Okay. Good morning, Harry. Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon for those who are following us from overseas. In fact, you asked a very complex question. I would start by saying this is a crisis that people were not expecting, but it's a crisis like no other because of its depth, because of its breadth, and also because of the uncertainty that is still surrounding it. This is the first time that the region is facing a shock of this magnitude in terms of economic activities, in terms of trade and trade-related issues due to the coronavirus shock itself and the need to respond by gradually locking in the economy. But I think what made it more complex is the huge impact that it had on the oil and oil market. This is the first time that we saw such a drop in oil prices in the last 20 years to reach level that we didn't see since early 2000, and in real terms since 1973. This affects, of course, oil exporting countries, but also the oil importing one, giving the strengths of the relationship in terms of remittances, investment, and capital flows that the oil importing countries and the oil exporting countries have together. The last issue is that most of those countries started or entered this crisis with, I would say, weak or weaker position compared to previous crises. Oil exporting were adjusting to the 2015 drop in oil price. Oil importing countries were struggling for low level of growth that they had to live with over the last decade, in addition to some of their issues related to inclusion, especially for the youth and the women. Therefore, this is a big shock that has affected the economies of the region. This is a shock that now, I would say countries were able to deal with it compared to what people were expecting fairly well in terms of the measures introduced to protect lives and to protect livelihoods. The challenge today is as we are moving from the phase one, I would say, where countries had to deal with the shock, to phase two, which is the aftermath of the shock and preparing for the recovery. Now we need to have new set of policies. We need to address the weaknesses that surfaced with the shock itself. And also we need to get ready through adjusting policies and reforms in order to strengthen the immunity of those economies.
Sorry about that. So Jihad, just to follow up with you before I turn to Rilla, what opportunities does the crisis offer, and how can countries leverage those opportunities? What sort of structural reforms that used to be difficult will now be feasible to push forward?
Well, very good question. There are a few silver linings. One is we saw technology playing an important role. And I think for a region that has more than 60% of the population below 30, it's an opportunity to expand, deepen the investment in technology and allow technology to address both the growth dimension as well as also the improvement of the service that are provided, not only in terms of public services, but also in terms of reaching out to those who are on the vulnerable side, like, for example, those who are in informality, those who are in the rural areas. Therefore, technology is one area where additional investment is needed and greater potential is available. This also would require greater collaboration among countries. Another opportunity is we are now faced with a certain number of uncertainties that will last for some time. And therefore, countries need to sharpen their policies and their planning. Make sure that they have, through their policies, the ability to address the weaknesses that we saw in the last wave. I take a few examples. The high level of informality led to I would say, limited impact on inclusion. And this is something that needs to be addressed. And there are also ways to do so. Second, we saw that certain sectors are affected where we have a lot of jobs, unskilled jobs, like, for example, in tourism and other type of sectors. Those require some special attention. Improving business environment, unlocking some of the potentials that those countries have. Those are opportunities that need to be captured. Last but not the least, stability matter, especially for countries where vulnerabilities are high. And therefore, now it's the time when we are, I would say, preparing for the recovery is to make sure that the vulnerabilities that have led, for example, like the high level of debt, are addressed.
Thank you, Jihad. I want to turn to Dr. Rilla Deshti in Beirut. Rilla, you're a former Minister of Planning in Kuwait, but the organization that you head right now is based in Lebanon, covering the region. I'd love to hear from you in terms of the social impacts of the coronavirus on the region. And Rilla, I see that your image is frozen, but hopefully we can hear you. And you'll need to unmute. Okay, there we go. We can see you better now, Rilla, but you need to unmute your mic. There you go.
Sorry, because I got cut off. So I was just hearing.
Rilla, I'll ask the question again. You know, just saying, you know, we heard from Jihad about the regional economic challenges and opportunities. You're a former minister of planning in Kuwait. You're based in Beirut right now, covering the region. I'd love to hear from you about the social impacts of the coronavirus, and maybe also some of the things that you think countries around the region should be working on to emerge from this crisis.
Thank you, Hadi, for having me part of the panel. And let me build on what Jihad has just mentioned and give some to our audiences some of our estimates on how the impact of COVID socially and economically impacting the region, and how much it highlighted, as Jihad just mentioned and magnified, the long challenges and addressed and revealed the weak spots the region has been encountering. First, let's talk about the conflict. We have now 55 million people who need humanitarian aid, and 26 million are forcibly displaced. And with the coronavirus, this puts a big pressure on the region, especially that the pandemic is global and impacting donor countries that might have it impacts on the humanitarian support needs to these vulnerable groups in terms of providing humanitarian support. In addition, is a big issue is the unemployment in our region, and especially the young adults unemployment, which is one of the highest in globally. Now, with COVID, we are talking about an additional estimate of 6 million jobs additionally. So it's compounding the impact of unemployment in the region, which gives us puts additional 14 million more people into poverty. So the region is expected now, the number of poor will be added another additional 14 million into it, reaching around 33% of the region's population becomes into poor. You just mentioned it, as well as Jihad, of the deep inequalities that is in the region, and this has been highlighted further, where we are having around 10 percentiles of the region on 76% of the region's household wealth, and the 50 poorest adults on only 2% of the household wealth. This deep inequality, the striking one, also will have a big impact on the region. In addition to this, Jihad, is we are also worried about the people, the pool, the vulnerable groups that we are talking about, especially when we're looking into the food, possible food insecurity, where we have around 50 million people are undernourished in the Arab region. 50% of the daily calorie intakes in our region is coming from food imports. And when we're talking about any disruption in supply chains in the food and production from food producing countries, that will impact also our region food insecurity. And this will impact also the vulnerable groups that we're talking about and the poor. Especially the region is a very high importer, and most of its stable food, 65% of its food is stability. Now, when we look at the COVID and how much is the impact of this COVID, in addition to what Jihad has mentioned on the impact on the fiscal space and the drops in revenues, tourism, remittances, and trade, we have estimated that the impact of COVID on the region, and to mitigate that impact, it will cost us around, the region needs around $300 billion to mitigate the impact of COVID. When you hear about the announcements of the region's stimulus packages, it reached only around $130 billion, making the region is in a deficit of additional $170 billion to mitigate the COVID-19. What does that mean? That means that recovering fast and better is also questionable in the region, and this will impact further and compound the problems, the challenges that the region will is having, and an additional thing. So from this perspective, the region is very much at risk. And now I'll talk about also the conflicts that is in the region. And this conflicts that sheds light, it's compounding it, because this will intensify the conflicts in the region further. And as much as the region might not be able to mitigate the impact of COVID socially and economically, this will put the region as at a more higher intensified risk of tension and social unrest in the region. So there's a lot of challenges that the region will be encountering and needs to be addressed. But can the region pull itself by itself? For sure, no. In terms of peace and security, it cannot pull itself by itself. It needs the international community involvement. Multilateralism is extremely important to address the conflict and bring solutions and peace to areas in conflict, so that people and the countries which are in conflict to start picking up itself. The second thing is that when we're talking about the impact where it is, and I do believe that this is not only a health crisis, it's a human crisis, but it's and which requires us to invest in survival. Now, the notion of investment in survival, it's people survival and also business survival. And the region needs to focus on these two elements of their investment in survival. And this is where we'll go into the small, medium businesses that we need to target.
I think we may have lost Rilla. Let's give her a second. Yeah, it looks like we may have lost Rilla. So while we're waiting for her to hopefully reconnect, maybe I'll address this, a question to Samantha, and then we'll see how to surf it depending on how quickly Rilla can reconnect. So turning to my colleague Samantha Gross at Brookings, who's a leading expert in energy studies. Samantha, talk to us for a second about what's happened in oil markets in the Middle East. You know, they look like they're recovering a bit to the very low prices we saw a little while back, but they're nowhere near, I think, where the Gulf economies need to be to recover. So, just tell us a little bit about, you know, what happened and where are we and where do you think we're going?
Sure. The most important thing to talk about in terms of oil markets is this incredible amount of demand destruction that we've seen in response to the virus. The way that the world is dealing with the virus, the only tool that we have to deal with the virus is social distancing, cutting down on people being together. And so that has cut back on travel, on trade. We have literally billions of people around the world staying home and not moving around in the way that we're used to. And so we lost an incredible amount of oil demand in response to this. Demand sort of day to day down as much as 25 to maybe even 30%. And so we've seen, as you would expect, very precipitous price drops in response to this drop in demand. The price war that started at the very beginning of this between the Saudis and the Russians wasn't exactly helpful. But frankly, we were going to see these price drops happen anyway. They may have just speeded up what was bound to happen anyway. What we're seeing right now is that oil prices are coming up a little bit off the very low levels they were at right now. I checked and Brent crude is at about $38 this morning. I also saw some articles over the weekend saying that May 2020 was one of the best months ever for oil, which I got a solid laugh out of, only because it started at the absolute bottom and I suppose came up by a good amount on percentage terms. But what this is it's nowhere near the price levels that the Gulf countries need in order to break even fiscally. Their production actually takes place at quite low price levels. And so those businesses are breaking even, but they need much higher prices to cover their fiscal kind of deficits. I'll talk the most about Saudi because it's really a bellwether for the region, plus it's the country that I know the best. It's believed that Saudi Arabia needs about $85 a barrel in order to meet all of its fiscal costs. And it's been a while since we've seen oil at $85 a barrel, even before we saw this, the COVID crisis come in. The increase in oil production here in the United States, the Saudis have more competition than they're used to. And the oil world looks quite different than it used to. In addition, we have changes that are taking place because of concerns about climate and wondering when the world will find a plateau of oil demand and we won't see growing demand anymore. So they were already facing challenges, already trying to decide how to reform their economy away from its incredible dependence on oil. And then this happens. So the responses that we've seen out of Saudi Arabia are quite painful for the country. A couple of weeks ago, we saw them triple the newly implemented VAT tax from 5% to 15%. They've also cut subsidies, put in place some austerity measures. And the real shame here is that these measures hit middle and lower income Saudis the hardest. And unlike many of the other oil-producing Gulf states that we think about, Kuwait, the UAE, Qatar, there are middle and lower income Saudis who are very much being hurt by these policies. And so it's a really difficult situation. They're nowhere near the kind of oil prices they need to fiscally break even. They're putting in place austerity measures that are particularly difficult and particularly regressive for many in their population, and they're really in a pickle. They're also cutting back more than their production costs might suggest that they need to, because they play the role and have for decades of the balancers of the oil market. So they're just really in a tough position right now. And that's on top of the actual effects of the virus itself.
Thanks, Samantha. Rolo, we went to Samantha for a bit while the technology got in the way, but you were well underway explaining to us a bunch of the region's challenges, and if you'd like to finish that up, that would be great. But I'd also like to ask you, Rolo, what do you think we need to do to fix all this as well? So I don't know if you'd like to address some of that.
Okay. I think it's about time that the development paradigm needs to be revisited, and the Arab states needs to visit the role of the state and the societal role and responsibilities and development. And we're talking about solidarity. And this notion of solidarity has to become the key issue in where we're addressing the development paradigms and the challenges that the region addresses. In terms, uplifting the poor, is it the sole responsibility of the state? Or is it a solidarity and joint responsibility between the top 10 percentile and the state? We're talking about role. Is it the role of the state is to be the provider of all economic activities, like in so many areas, or is it a shared responsibility that the private sector has to play a role in provision of the economic activities? So I think it's about time to start revisiting it in terms of governance, in terms of political participation, in terms of so the issue of the whole revisiting the paradigm, the development paradigm, the societal roles and responsibilities are a key issue now for the region to recover better and to recover fast. This is one of the issues. The issue of the conflict in the region, we cannot escape the issue of the conflicts and the increasing intensity and tension in the region. And with COVID paradigm and the cost that is COVID will incur in the region, this will compound the conflict into it, even for countries which are a little bit semi-stable, but the social impact of the COVID and the economic impact of COVID will drive more of a social tension that we need to address it further. And this is where the solidarity comes. And then we're talking about the solidarity. We're seeing the solidarity, we visualize it as solidarity within the nation and the solidarity across countries. It's no country in the region will mitigate on its own the impact of COVID into it. And this is where we need to strengthen regional solidarity in various issues in terms. And this is where we talk about the food security issues. We're talking about the trade. We're talking about now issues of migration issues into it, water resources, transboundary issues that needs to be addressed collectively in an impact. So that the region needs to be, you can't have a country that will be prosperous where a region could be depressed. So the region in totality needs to be prosperous, so to have a sustainable peace to visiting. And as I said, also, we need to revisit our consumption and production patterns to make it more sustainable. Into it. This is an extremely important issue. Oil will never, as an example, in the GCC, for example, oil revenue since 2015, oil revenues totally in the region was not enough to cover the government expenditures. And there was a huge drain on the sovereign funds reserves. And this is cannot. And now when we're saying these low prices that we've seen on oil, that makes it a huge increased burden on deficits. And it's estimated that the GCC by themselves, because of the reduction in oil revenues and giving their government spendings requirements, we're expecting that they need around $166 billion. And we're talking about almost 10 to 12% of their sovereign funds. And this is for COVID, the impact of COVID and to mitigate for 2020 and 21. And if you don't get, and this is, we're talking about the high wealth oil countries in the region. And so the fiscal space is an issue that crosses the whole region, irrespective if you are in high-income countries, middle-income countries, or least the developed countries, or countries in conflict. So we need to revisit our thinking. We need to revisit our expenditure patterns, make them more efficient. We need to revisit our governance and accountability and transparency. We need to revisit and make it more efficient spending behavior of it. The spending needs to create opportunities. We need to have to revisit our production levels. We are spending on economic activities that are poor growing economic activities. When we need to go into sectors that has a high value addition economic activities, and Jihad has mentioned into the investments in the technology divide, the green technology issues, sustainability is very important. So there is a lot of challenges, but at the same time, there is a lot of opportunities that the region can take advantage of COVID.
Thank you, Rula. That was excellent. Let me just finish up a little bit with Samantha, and I'm starting to see we have some questions coming in. So Samantha, you are well underway, but can you tell us, did the oil war between Russia and Saudi Arabia make any difference, or did it really kind of leave things, was it just kind of a blip and things returned to the path that they were on already?
Well, there's two different ways of looking at that. One is the difference that it made in oil markets, and the other is the difference that it made in how people viewed both the Saudis and the Russians. Frankly, in terms of oil markets, I really do believe it was a blip. I think that prices may have fallen more quickly than they would have otherwise, but because of the incredible disruption in demand, I think prices were going there anyway, and they just got there a bit more quickly than they might otherwise have. However, and this is my opinion, but one strongly held, I really feel like the Saudis played their hand incredibly poorly on that in terms of their relations with other nations, and in particular the United States. When they were angry at the Russians for not accepting cuts, they said, fine, we're just going to start an oil war. Obviously, that didn't last long. It was not the right move at the right time because of the destruction of demand. But what it did was really raised the ire of others around the world, particularly here in the States. thinking that the Saudis had brought prices down to that level. A really interesting thing happened. Several tankers of Saudi oil were sold at quite low prices to consumers here in the United States. And I got calls from reporters, what's going to happen to those tankers? Is President Trump going to do something about those tankers? And I said, well, the U.S. imports oil all the time. We import oil because it's a better fit for our refineries, even as we export oil to other countries. I'm like, look, U.S. producers bought that oil. We buy outside oil all the time. But the symbolism that took place there and this idea that the Saudis were sort of out to destroy the U.S. oil industry and were destroying oil prices was terrible, even though oil prices were going there anyway. So I think they played their hand poorly politically in that, but I don't think it made a ton of a difference in the overall shape of oil prices over the longer term.
Thank you, Samantha. Jihad, a question's come in that I think I might direct in your direction. It relates to Iraq. So, the question is, and I'll read it, can Iraq cope with a difficult and hot summer? Will the IMF push Iraq to ensure that gas and electricity production can continue? And what are the expectations that the IMF has for Iraq moving forward at this moment, given the challenges it was facing before and now the coronavirus crisis?
Well, in the oil exporting group, you have two categories. You have countries who were affected by the crisis, but with a sufficient amount of buffers to allow them to, I would say, reduce the pressure on their economy of the drop in oil price. And those who have less buffers, and Iraq is among those who have less buffers. And therefore, when the crisis affected them, it added on their economic weaknesses. And therefore, I think it's important for Iraq, like other countries in the oil exporting arena, is to use this crisis in order to address some of their structural weaknesses in order for them to be able to cover for the loss in revenues. On the other hand, address the social impact of that and to maintain their macroeconomic stability. And this is where it's very important to move on two tracks. One is to respond to the crisis itself. And in the case of Iraq, we saw recently that the coronavirus itself, as a pandemic, it's still expanding. And this is a priority number one. Priority number one is protect lives. Priority number two is to protect livelihoods, especially for those who are on the low income level and those who are in the informality. Priority number two is to preserve the macroeconomic stability of the Iraqi economy. And this requires a certain number of structural reforms that will allow a country like Iraq, who has a lot of potential, not only in oil, but also in other type of commodities, to in fact have a good use of those in order for the economy, especially for the non-oil sector, to grow. This is in fact draw the attention now more and more about the policy and the response, because now we're moving from the phase one of the shock to, I would say, the phase two, whereby what is needed is A, to protect the economy from other shocks in the future and allow the system, the healthcare system, to cope with that. But also, on the other hand, to make sure that economic activities are restarting and some of the weaknesses are being addressed. We saw over the last few months, countries or governments putting in place a certain number of fiscal measures, on average 2.5% of GDP in the region, and also some financial measures. Those now to be revisited in order to see what is needed to be expanded and what is needed to be adapted. And on the other hand, it's the right time to address some of the structural issues that will allow the economies to have not only to address the short-term issues, but also to think medium-term. And this is where, in fact, the framework should be for most of the oil exporting countries. Of course, each country has its own situation in terms of population, in terms of level of buffers. And therefore, each country will define the right pace and the right speed going forward.
Thank you, Jihad. That was excellent. Rula, can you hear?
Yes.
Very good. So a question for you from my colleague and our mutual friend, Dr. Tamara Wittes, who mentions or sort of asks, how or what can be done to ensure that the crisis can help, make governments in the region more accountable and more responsive to citizens. What are the mechanisms we can use to kind of enable a positive change for transparency and accountability?
Thank you. Thank you, Hadi. I do think we need, because of the pressure on the fiscal space, because of the pressure of increasing social impact on various groups and the increasing vulnerable groups, I think that's why we're talking about using the solidarity concept in the issue of solving the solution and the bringing another actor to be part of the solution. This will start engaging and putting the government as more transparent. In a sense, when we're talking about the poor in the Arab region, and we take the middle income class, we found out in a recent study that will be coming out very shortly at ESQA, that if you take the middle income class, which are highly indebted, and you look into their level of poverty people, we found out that if you take the 10 percentile citizens in these countries and create a solidarity tax, about less than 2%, you will be able to eradicate poverty, and you uplift these people to the poverty line, uplift them from poverty in this middle income class for every single country with less than 10%. But what we're talking about is that this bringing the top 10 percentile of the economy, of the people in the society to become part of the development and sustainable development by creating a solidarity tax. But that tax doesn't go back to the fiscal, as we see the fiscal space of the government. But that tax goes to a certain fund that is managed by collaboratively between the people, the 10 percentile and the state, and targeted towards the vulnerable, the poor people, to uplift them and creating opportunities. Then you become getting the amount and the solidarity and the funds going targeted and getting the improvement of it. This will end up having people to make the state more responsible in terms, and because now it's not the state says it's my only responsibility. Now the responsibility is a shared responsibility. And when we talk about shared responsibility, this is, for example, from a social dimension of poverty. But when we talk about shared responsibility and economic activities, and this becomes the governance of it, and where the state plays a role of becoming only the regulator and supervisor, and the private sector is becoming the investor and the creator of jobs and for these economics and the providing of the services to the people, then accountability is not rested totally on the state, and it becomes shared responsibility that becomes the more you take power from the state on their responsibility and distribute it to a wider spectrum of group of people, then the governance part becomes embedded, that it becomes shared. So we're doing the governance part and accountability through sharing responsibility and transforming responsibility to other actors, stakeholders within society, so that the society thrives totally and society becomes solidified much more. Into it. Vis-a-vis, the concept is that the total responsibility is on the government, and then we have to make the government accountable because we are giving them the money, for example, or they are controlling the wealth of the state. Now we're saying, no, let's distribute it, so lessening their power structure, then you're indirectly bringing different stakeholders to the scene in the development spectrum.
Thank you, Rula. Samantha, there's a question that I think has come in for you. So I'll address this in your direction. And I'll just kind of read the question to you. It says, how will GCC OPIC, relations with African OPIC states move forward as, Saudi Arabia in particular is taking market share in Asia at the expense of the OPIC countries? So just sort of talking about how the strain will impact the relations within OPEC itself.
I think this could be a real challenge going forward. And I think this happens against the backdrop of what is likely to be a prolonged slump in oil prices and in oil demand. A lot of this, as I keep saying every time I talk to anyone, it really depends on the course of the virus, how long we stay in this zone, whether we have recurrences of the virus around the world. But my opinion is that we're likely to be in a low price time for a while. And that is incredibly hard on the producers in Africa. I mean, they do generally sort of shade down the kind of reductions that they ask for out of the African countries. But it's very difficult for, the giants of OPEC, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Kuwait, to maintain a greater than called for cuts to keep prices up even a little bit when they have their own fiscal problems. In times where prices are fat, where there's more to go around, it's much easier for them to work with the African producers. But I think they're going to be in a world of hurt because the Gulf countries can't afford to be cutting them the kind of slack that they might otherwise do. The Gulf producers need those Asian markets and are pushing very hard for them to keep their own fiscal situations in line. Plus, those African countries are likely to have their very own quite serious COVID outbreaks to deal with. So I think this could be a real challenge for some of the smaller producers within OPEC, particularly within Africa, and could be a challenge in keeping OPEC together. However, OPEC has always been kind of a loose agglomeration where the big guys put the ideas forward and many of the smaller guys frankly cheat. And so I expect you might continue to see that happen.
Thank you, Samantha. Jihad, back to you. I guess one of the questions that has come in is, how is the IMF really helping the various countries and right now? And then sort of in addition to that, how strict is the IMF going to be in terms of pushing for reform as to move out of this crisis? And are we going to see certain countries as too big to fail, so in the end the country will get the assistance anyway, even if they're refusing the reforms?
Well, Hadi, as you know, the fund has responded very quickly and moved along four dimensions. One is a financial dimension, and we have in the last 2 months in the region extended more than $12 billion, which by the end of the year will exceed our exposure by 70%. And we recognize the fact that this is an exogenous shock and those countries need emergency support. And therefore, we provided for those countries emerging support facilities that is not attached with any condition. Also, we have provided certain number of grants for countries who cannot borrow, like, for example, the case in Yemen. We have provided Yemen with grant, which is exceptional situation because of their exceptional exceptional conditions. And also, we did for Somalia a debt relief operation that allows Somalia now to be back. Therefore, the first response from the fund was to provide support to countries financially because of the magnitude and because of the because of the fact that it's an exogenous shock. But also, we have provided other type of supports in terms of policy and policy solutions. We have put in place a certain number of platforms that allow our countries to address some of the shocks, implications on their economy, how to deal with the fiscal, especially for countries who have a very, very limited fiscal space. What are the type of measures one could introduce on the financial front in order to keep the liquidity functioning in the system and provide access to finance, especially for the small and medium-sized companies in order to protect livelihoods. The fund also moved in terms of technical support by scaling up the capacity of countries in terms of technical and policy reforms. Last but not the least is the global coordination. We have provided more than 60 countries with immediate facilities in less than 2 months for more than $60 billion now. And we are also working on other type of facilities that address different type of issues. We are very much concerned about the financial health of the low-income countries in the world and the emerging economies. Those are countries who have been affected not only by the COVID shock, but also by the fact that the financial markets turned negative on them. And we saw some of them being able to pay high level of spreads to access markets or not being able to access markets. In fact, this is where we are today at the fund after, I would say, a massive emergency support that we provided. And in the region, we were, I would say, among the first. And our amount of financing is the largest among any international financial institution. Now we're moving in order to help countries address some of their country-specific issues. And this is here country by country, like we are trying to help Egypt with a new program or Jordan with a program where it's geared toward helping Jordan to grow. We are also working with several countries and several regional institutions in order to strengthen the regional cooperation with the Arab Monetary Fund, the Arab Fund for Economic and Social Development, the GCC Secretariat, and other entities. We are trying to keep the policymakers thinking together in order to find out solutions that would address their problems, but also will take care of regional cooperation, and also how we can team up our resources in order to expand the support that is needed. It's a global crisis. Countries of the region cannot afford dealing with it on their own. They need international assistance, and also they need to think forward about how to use this crisis as an opportunity, especially when we have risks of social unrest. And our indicator that we publish on regular basis is showing an increase in social tensions. When we have, although we saw a strong improvement in social protection, still the region lags behind in terms of healthcare, in terms of education, and this needs to be brought up. And in terms of governance, we're about to publish a study on that that shows there is a great deal of need to invest in improving fiscal institutions, improving procurement, financial institutions, transparency, and this is a way to strengthen the social contract between citizen and state. Therefore, I think where we are today, it's an important moment whereby all the stakeholders need to work together, government and policymakers, we as regional or international institutions, and I would say the other stakeholders, the society at large, whereby we need to bring the private sector, the CSOs, as partners in charting the future.
Thank you, Jihad. here, another question has come in, and maybe I will, direct it your way, Rula. Given the huge crisis that the region is in, and the last two or three decades that have, or at least the last decade that has built up, how can the region really come together to solve these problems, given the political divisions that exist in the region? Do you think that the coronavirus crisis will enable countries to transcend their differences, or will it actually exacerbate, tensions within the region?
Thank you, Hadi. I wish the region conflicts was regional. Unfortunately, it is international. Various international actors are part of the region's conflict. So it's not enough to transcend the region differences and political differences. It's and this is where multilateralism is extremely important, regarding the conflict and solving the conflict of the region and establishing lasting peace into it. So our actors are not regional actors. COVID also dimension, and that what worries me is that it can intensify the conflict. And in a two sense, one of them is worry and concern of re-emergence of ISIS, especially with this conflict. It might, the COVID conflicts might accelerate the withdrawal of the U.S. troops from Syria and Iraq, and where ISIS will be regrouping and start increasing regrouping and start increasing their attacks. So there is an intensifying actor coming up to the scene, and COVID is not solving a conflict, but it might cause an intensifying on the issue of re-emergence of ISIS. The second part is, as I said, there is 55 million humanitarian individuals in the region who are dependent on humanitarian aid. And COVID, the impact of COVID globally on all on donor countries, and the worry is that these donor countries might start having a humanitarian fatigue, and they are much more immersed in their solving their national concerns and the national mitigation measures to mitigate COVID impact nationally, and so the eyes on the humanitarian side of the region and the people in the region is becomes a problem. A third worry is that COVID not create an opportunity but create another tension is the rise of racist nationalism and migrant workers in the region, and this is could be also could compound the problem that Jihad was talking about, the middle income class and supporting the middle income class. But when you start seeing huge migrant workers from the GCC going back to their home countries, whether it was Jordan or Egypt, which they compound the social and economic impact, not only from issues of remittances, but also on additional burden to these countries, and the racist nationalism within the GCC countries that is being picked up. You worry about, as a result of COVID, we worry about that intensify the divide also on the region. And in spite of this, we feel that leaders in the region can also rise to their responsibility in terms of regional solidarity. And this is where we think there might be an opportunity. And this is where we were calling for a regional solidarity fund that brings the people together, so to address COVID impact to the vulnerable groups and bring the mainstream individual within the region integrated further, so that who has is supporting, who has not, in a solidarity a framework to ease a little bit of tension. It can create also, COVID can create that opportunity of furthering regional, I'm not going to say the politically loaded regional integration phrase, but more of regional alliances in terms of trade, in terms of issues, and looking into the food security issue for the region in totality because of the worry of the supply chains, and becomes more integrated part of a food security policies as a regional issue. Third is very important, and the issue of water. Water is a key issue, part of the problem. The consumption of water has been increased, but we see there is also the issue of water that could rise not only as a COVID, but could rise in the future as a conflict tension that we need to address. There is some opportunities. Leaders and within the region can rise up to ease the tension of COVID, but the worry, my more important worry is that with the region learns a lesson and sees the opportunity of COVID to recover better and fast. And my concern and worry with the structural, needed structural adjustments and needed looking into structural mitigations, hardcore decisions to that structural, addressing long-standing structural weaknesses of the region is that we end up coming back, resorting to the old, more of the same decision-making mechanism and implementation processes that waste resources, that hinders up creation of opportunities, that deep weakening institutions and governance systems instead of improving this. So this is what my worry, that we miss an opportunity to deepen more the challenges of the region. And this is, and when you tell me, where do you see 50-50? No, I see more of 70-30. Taking the opportunity is 30%. More of the same decision-making processes is the 70%. And it just like we go from 2020, maybe 2021, and then you get back to the region. The oil impact might be a forced revisiting of the structure by force. I mean, but if in 2022 we see back a rise in the oil prices and the markets start to pick up and stuff like that, the whole thinking of reforms and revisiting will just wash out. For sure it will just wash out. Taking hard decisions is not something the region would like to address, policymakers in the region would like to address.
Thank you, Rula. Samantha, a question I think that you could help us grapple with, which is a very interesting one, which is, you know, will you know, the depressed oil prices impact the drive for sustainable energy in the region among oil producers? So, you know, Saudi Arabia had talked a lot in recent years about going to, you know, renewable resources and whatnot, but now with the lower oil prices, do you think those plans are going to be on, you know, stalled, and thus having a, you know, really kind of a negative impact on the environment?
My concern about the Gulf oil producers is similar to my concern about oil producers across the board and their green investments. The situations are not that different. And that is, in a low price environment, there's just less money available for these kinds of investments. And that's unfortunate. This kind of builds a little on what Rola Ant said in the last question. You need to see transition, but it's difficult to transition during a time of crisis. But it's also difficult to transition during a time of plenty. There's never a good and easy time to make a transition. And so we're seeing these investments, a lot of them are being made, particularly in the Gulf region, with the idea that they'd like to see more power made from renewables to free up oil for export. And so that entire idea looks a bit less attractive at times of low oil prices, or if you're concerned about having low oil prices for quite some time, which I think we're going to have. I think it's going to take a while to work off the inventories that we have. So I am concerned about those green investments. On the other hand, if you think of those green investments not in terms of trying to increase oil imports, but of trying to diversify the economy, then that makes them look more attractive and helps to keep them off of the chopping block. But there's such a tight revenue situation right now that I think it may be really hard to keep those investments going, just like it is in many of the Western oil companies.
Thank you. Thank you, Samantha. And here's a question, I think, for both Jihad and Rola. Maybe Jihad, I'll turn to you first, and then Rola. One of the questions that's come in is something I mentioned in the introduction, which is the corruption in the region, and not just the actual impact of corruption, but also the deep frustration that citizens around the world feel about the monies that have been siphoned off from government and the lack of opportunity that they have as ordinary citizens. How can we, you know, what do you expect the impact of the crisis to be on corruption, and how can international institutions work together to do its best to root out corruption, which this viewer and also I personally believe is really very deep part of the challenges that the region faces?
Well, Hadi, I cannot agree with you more. This is something that we have been working on over the last few years here at the fund in order to strengthen our framework to address this issue, because this is an issue that not only affects the public finance, but erodes the confidence between citizen and state and create a situation, especially when you have this level of exclusion in the society, a lot of frustration that leads into social unrest. And this is something that we have tackled at two levels, at the country-by-country level in our consultation, but also at a regional level, whereby we, in fact, studied where the key weaknesses are, and there are certain weaknesses that need to be addressed. I give you examples. Institutions. Institutions need to be improved in terms of the quality of their operation, fiscal institutions, revenue administration, and all kinds of fiscal operations. Procurement and procurement laws, regulations, and procurement framework. Transparency and access to information. Those are important elements that we can start with that can uplift the capacity of countries to address some of those risks. Last but not the least is strong judicial system and independent judicial power. Those are things that the region needs. It is a must if you want to have strong recovery, because this is how you can attract additional investment. This is how you can make citizen being more compliant with their fiscal rules. And also, this is how you can create a strong partnership between citizen and state in order to accept to for citizens to pay more in order to broaden the solidarity framework, as Rula was mentioning. And on that, I think let's use in what has happened over the last 2 months. Despite the weaknesses in institutions and despite the weaknesses in investment in healthcare infrastructure, we saw that most of the countries in the region were able to address the shock of the coronavirus, were able to manage a certain number of public services in a way that one can build on. I think what we need to do, that we are now at an important crossroad, whereby if we keep business as usual, and I totally agree with, you know, with the other speakers, we will be in a situation where gradually we will go down, in a situation where the challenges are immense. Or we use this as a way to step up, stepping up by building a new solidarity framework in terms of addressing the fiscal distribution, improving social protection, and this is something that we will demonstrate in a study that will come public in a few weeks, how we can improve social and economic outcome by improving investment in health and education. And also, last but not the least, there is a huge potential of growth that now the global value chains are changing. We are entering into a new phase of globalization where we will see growth coming from shorter value chain. We will see growth coming from next door markets. And therefore, this is an opportunity for countries who have failed over the last 3 decades to create an economic platform that allow goods and services to move from one country to another, that will allow information to circulate and technology to be expanded. Therefore, this is a defining moment. And this moment is, the war is not lost here. And last but not the least, I think we need to underscore the importance of addressing the issue of refugees internally displaced. And those issues are international issues, of course, but also regional issues. We need to help those groups and communities who are currently facing tremendous challenges in order to help them, not only from, I would say, public health perspective, but also from integrating them and providing them with certain support, which will allow the region to tackle the issue of inclusion for the youth, for the women, as well as also for the groups who are currently outside the system.
Thank you, Jihad. Rola, you spoke very eloquently before about poverty, but what about corruption, and what should we be doing on the corruption issue, especially you being in Beirut?
I'll do agree what Jihad has mentioned of all important pillars and dimensions he added, but and I'll add a couple of additional things. One of them, I think, multinational financial institutions should start putting conditionality and targeting the support. Just not the fiscal space goes to the state, but target this and monitor the spending. Conditionality on where the spending should be and targeting the spending into the targeted groups where citizens and the people is at the core front of the support itself. The other good thing we have seen and it showcased is that when states are transparent, citizens restore faith in the government. And this is what we saw when the states in the whole Arab region starting addressing the health issues regarding COVID and announcements and how many cases there is and they're becoming transparent. So transparency becomes a very key issue for rebuilding. And this is where we want to work and put rules, regulations, social media could help and broadening the dimensions that to enhance transparency within the system, because this is shows that by state acting transparently, then confidence, citizens' confidence increases. And the other thing, and I think, is that adoption of technology. I think an adoption of technology, digitalization of government services also can be a measure that curb part of the corruption. And And most importantly, to curb corruptions, you need to create opportunities. And creating opportunities and fair opportunities to everybody. Once you have people feel that the system is fair and creating opportunities to it, I think corruption starts to be easy, eased off a little bit, especially in, for sure, as I said, what Jihad has said, the judicial system, the procurement processes, all of this, I do agree. But I think also the creation of opportunities and a fair, the corruption could subside a little bit, and especially when in the region now, because of lack of opportunity, because of limited income, because of people are driven to more of poverty, is that petty corruption is becoming enlarged and expanded. We're not talking about grand corruptions now. We're putting, and this is which destroys the system and the state and the structure and the fabric, the society itself, the expansion of petty corruption, because it becomes part of the system. It's normal, it's acceptable. And this becomes hard to rebuild a strong, resilient state when you institutionalize petty corruptions. And this is what we need to avoid, is institutionalizing petty corruptions within the system, because this is where you're calling for the death of society in terms. And this is where I'm saying you need to link it with creating the opportunities. And this is where the when I say the supporting financial institutions, the donor communities, is that they need to have the conditionalities targeted to create opportunities for a larger group of citizens within society.
Thank you, Rilla. We've had a question come in on Iran, and you know, I thought maybe Jihad and Samantha could just give a quick response because we only have a few minutes left. What do we expect for economic growth or stagnation in Iran in the next, you know, in the next year or so? I mean, is it looking rough? Is it looking rosy? What do you all see?
Well. Iran will face for the third year negative growth with a situation where inflation has went up to high level in the last couple of years and still we expect inflation to exceed 20% this year. This definitely had a big social impact on the low income, middle income people. Has been compounded by the coronavirus shock, as Iran is one of the hotspots of the COVID-19. And we all feel the pain of the population that has been, in addition to the suffering from the sanctions, has to endure the impact of the COVID-19 too. The decline in oil price also is for a country where oil is still one of the sectors. Of course, the Iranian economy has diversified outside oil, but still has a negative impact. Therefore, the situation, like other oil exporting countries, has been affected by the two shocks, maybe more than others. And the sanctions added and compounded those challenges.
Thank you, Jihad. Samantha, you know, Iran is you know, an oil producer, although less of an oil exporter these days. How do you see Iran's future from your angle moving forward?
Well, something that we haven't brought up in today's conversation, but, you know, with 5 minutes left, why not, is the U.S. political situation. We have certainly seen Iran as just a real bugaboo to the Trump administration, and he worked very hard to go back and undo everything that the prior president put in place. So what happens in November, I think, matters for the situation in Iran. We have to remember that we can't go back to where we were previously, before Trump was elected, before he pulled out of the JCPOA. That place doesn't exist anymore. But with a new administration with a slightly different approach, we might be able to find ourselves in a better place and get to the point where Iran can resume at least some oil exports. Perhaps we have an administration that allows some exceptions to the sanctions in certain instances. Because Iran really has suffered due to the COVID outbreak, and you don't want to put the United States in a situation where we're making it worse for the average Iranian citizen. And I fear that we're there right now. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens in November and how that plays out. We can't go back to where we were, but perhaps we can find our way to someplace that's slightly better.
Thank you, Samantha. As we close out in the next minute in this really important conversation of the impact of coronavirus on the region and poverty, corruption, and social protection in the region, Rula, any last remarks from you on how we can all really work together moving forward to ensure a more productive future?
Sure. I think there is a lot of opportunities in the region that we can support and assist in terms of creating the solidarity, in terms of involving various stakeholders to uplift the vulnerable groups. We spoke about the poor people, but there is an important dimension, also an important community, let me say, of the society is the middle income class, that we need to address and ensure their stability, because as we see and this is where we need to support, because as we're going along, the middle income class in the region is being shrinking. In the last 10 years, it's shrank by almost an average 10% in the region. And in some countries, it went further to 20% and even more. And this is what worries me when we start giving assistance and talking about restructuring reforms and addressing the structural changes. The people who takes the burden of this is the middle income class, and we need to revisit our policies. And this is where we can collaborate and rethink, because we need to become creative in the policy propositions, that not to have more impacting policy to the middle income class, that they are the ones who gets the majority of the burden on these reforms. And this is what usually traditionally the policies of any restructuring adjustments are taking, and reforms is that the group that gets targeted and hit badly to pay for these structural reform policies is the middle income class, which I think now the middle income class in that region cannot anymore afford any contribution, let me say, in the reform. And this is where we said the solidarity, and you have to bring the different stakeholders into the play, and where we're putting the solidarity tax fund proposition on the 10 percentiles into it. Corruption is an extremely important thing, and it's a responsibility for all of us, and it should not be left to the state to reform itself to make it to become more transparent, but it has to be pushed by all stakeholders into it, I push hard because this is an important fate for our society, especially in the concepts of corruption. And I said it's a very dangerous that to institutionalize petty corruptions within it. And this is where we can work so much importantly, how to bring different actors and push for transparency within the system and avoid institutionalizing petty corruptions and creating opportunities.
Thank you, Rula. So just in closing, Jihad, in the remaining minute or two, any closing remarks and message for our audience about what to be thinking about moving forward, about what will happen in the region and what we need to do working together moving forward?
The strategy of the fund was over the last few years to work on inclusive growth in the region, because we think this is the highest priority. And I think after the coronavirus shock, it is more important than ever. What does it mean? It means that the region needs to focus on what's going around, because the level of uncertainty is high. And we are at the moment where the global economy is shifting grounds. It's very important to be alert. It's very important to build on the strength. The region has some strengths: resilience, young population, talented population. And also it is at the crossroad of important trade and service routes. And therefore, I think it's very important for the region to use this as a defining moment in order to address the challenges. And the challenges, we know them, we have spoke about them. The way to address them is to go in a constructive and cooperative way internally and create a new social contract between various stakeholders to address country by country issues. The way to deal with it is at the regional level, to create a platform for better cooperation and collaboration that addresses the challenges that have been there for decades and allow gradually to move on the barriers. How to deal with it is to create an international coalition to help this important part of the world to recover and use this crisis as launching pad for new recovery. It is of importance to Europe, it's of importance to Asia, and also it's of importance to the global stability. Therefore, I think we need to turn what we are seeing today as a challenge, which is a big one, as a way to look at it and to push for an opportunity here to address long-standing issues, but also to do it in a way that will allow people of, especially the 60% of the population below 30, to see a future and to see a bright future. I think this is where we are today, and this is what we should all aspire to. And this is where we as an institution, as the International Monetary Fund, how we see our role.
Thank you, Jihad. Thank you, Rula. Thank you to my colleague, Samantha Gross. This has been an important conversation on the impact of coronavirus on the region, and particularly the roles of social protection, poverty, and corruption. I want to thank our speakers. I want to thank our audience. And I'd like to thank our viewers in Washington, the U.S., around the world, and our great team here at Brookings for putting this together. I've learned a lot. It's been an honor to have such a distinguished panel. And we look forward to staying in touch with all of you as the world hopefully turns the corner to a more productive future. Thank you very much to all of our speakers.